Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This is part one in a four-part series on politics and comedy. I've been speaking to the people who write jokes about politicians and for them and asking whether there is a serious point to being funny about the people who run the country. In later episodes, we'll hear from comedians Al Murray, Andy Zaltzman, Tiff Stevenson and The Times' own Hugo Rifkin, plus Daniel Finkelstein, James McGrory and Ayesha Hazarika on the pitfalls of politicians who try to make us laugh. In this episode, I talk to comedian and impressionist Rory Bremner, who gives voice to Donald Trump, David Cameron, Boris Johnson and William Hague, while discussing the politicians too dull to mimic, the difference between satire and topical comedy, and what Julian Clary and John Major have in common. But first, I began by asking him how he came to do what he does.
Whatever it is you do, how did you start? It was Edinburgh. Well, I did reviews and things when I was at university. We did sort of like, you know, student shows, sketchy shows. And I did my first Edinburgh Festival in 81, of all, just a long, long time ago. At that time, life was like they had a Conservative Party. It was, you know, woman Prime Minister, divided on Europe. I mean, it's so different from nowadays, completely different time. And by 83, I was doing sort of stand-up on my own. I started my first Edinburgh Festival. Well, the stand-up was 84 with Mark Steele, who's still going strong, and Jenny Eclair. I think it's partly because I was born in Edinburgh and brought up in Edinburgh, so I was kind of always inspired by the Fringe and what was going on there. And it was an incredible time, if you think. That was when Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson and Clive Anderson and Rory McGrath and all these people and more were kind of just starting out. So it was a kind of an inspiring time, and I lived in Edinburgh anyway. And Voices was my way into that world. And so that's how I started out. And then, so for years I did sort of sports commentators but I'd always had an interest in politics. And when I worked with John Wells in the sort of later 80s, that sort of developed more. And working with John Byrne and John Fortune, it became more political, but that's where I wanted to go. And they kind of mentored me. So, you know, the show became progressively more political. And I think partly because television was fragmenting into so many different audiences, there was no guarantee that somebody who knew, I don't know, people who did gardening programs knew who the sports characters were. But yeah, there was one thing we had in common, which was current affairs and news. So I kind of focused on that, and it became a sort of a fascination to the point of obsession. But it all began really at university and in Edinburgh.
So how do you go about the mechanics of learning a voice?
Wow. Oh, gosh. I listen to it on the radio as much as I can until it's got to go into your head. You've got to be able to hear it in your head when the person isn't there. I mean, what you're doing as an impressionist, I think a lot of it is instinctive. Yeah. You can't really teach people to do it. I think actors, they can be taught dialects and things, but that's, you're sort of self-selecting as an actor anyway. I think you've got a propensity to very often have a musical ear. I mean, most actors, I think, can sing. And if you can sing, you can do voices because you recognise that sound. So you've got to hear it clearly. So you might play a tape again and again and again, or just allow yourself to absorb a sound. The visuals, that's instinctive, because what you're doing in some ways as an impressionist is you're playing a film in your head and you're providing the soundtrack, if you like. So
already did a little see, for example, I was doing Boris, and I cannot, you cannot help but to physicalize, to do the appropriate stroking of the hair and the gestures. Or if it was Cameron, I know he has that open fingered sort of hand gesture, and I think that becomes part of it. You can't help but to do the body language when you're doing the voice. You've got to be able to recognise that voice. And remarkably, only a week ago, I heard somebody being interviewed on the radio, the Today programme. It was about the 8:10 interview, and I thought, oh, who's this? I don't know who this is. Who's it? And it was about 3 or 4 minutes in that I realised it was Jeremy Corbyn. And well, that was interesting in its way, because I thought I hadn't really registered the voice, and you need the public to register it as well. So that's why people like William Hague, for his so many years, was such a great gift to impressions, because he was so recognisable. And for an impressionist, you need to have a certain key. Like if you're putting plaster on a wall, you need to have a certain key. You need to have a way in. You need to have some characteristics. But then, of course, your job is in the way that a caricaturist does. You exaggerate certain features and you extend. And often you start out as an impression being very close to the original. And then as you start to play with it more, as it becomes more familiar, then you can actually start to be that character. I mean, John Major, for example, when he first started, for years and years, we used to always say, people had a sort of a train spotting voice. It's, oh, yes, I know the times of all the trains. Oh, look, there's a 727 and it leaves Dorking and it stops at every station on that. And that was our train spotter. And then all of a sudden, this man emerged. And my God, he had the train spotter voice, if I may say. I don't mean in the Ewan McGregor sense, obviously. But no, it was a combination of that. It was a combination of the train spotter voice with a little bit of Julian Clary. So Julian Clary sort of softened it. And if you get the softening of Julian Clary with the train spotter voice, you get that, if I may say so, Matt. So that was the way in. So sometimes impressions are a combination of two different ones, like Ken Clark. Yeah, he's got that sort of dyspeptic, slight sort of indigestion, which was Alan Corran. For years he did the news quiz and had that kind of, and Portillo's a little bit like that. So you notice, just as a pianist will notice, if you're a jazz pianist, you'll hit a certain chord and think, oh, that reminds me of so-and-so. So you can often combine them, but if you take, as I say, the train spotter and Julian Clary equals John Major, or Alan Corran taking up a volume to get Ed Miliband. I can never get Ed Miliband. I made Ed Miliband sounded like Tony Blair with a cold. So it was just like, but then I realised he's got that Chris Tarrant adenoise. Okay, so what we're going to do is, could it be A? Could it be? And you take that kind of quality, and then you just add the. I just think it's the Labour leader. I just think people want to recognise. And the letter L, I worked sometimes with a voice coach now, and it's the letter L. He said, Labour leaders. I don't want to lose elections. So you're just putting different things into the mix. Another way of doing it is certain vowel sounds. When Malcolm Rifkin started out, of course, it was the letter O, and I don't suppose. We actually wrote a script, which was, you know, that thing about Moses supposes his toes are roses. So I actually wrote a sketch, a script where Malcolm Rifkin talking about Saddam Hussein, which is, well, that presupposes he knows we oppose his proposals. And that was part comment, as you like, but mostly it was just a voice exercise.
And presumably, for the viewers, the voice is only half the thing. It's also got to be funny.
It is, absolutely. It's got to be funny. Well, that's the thing. And ideally, when the two come together, I mean, well, there's three things. I often think there's a true line, in a sense that here's a line of something which you believe is true. And I think satire should do that. It should release a truth. And so you get that response in an audience of they're laughing on two levels. They're laughing because it's funny, but also there is that recognition that you distilled something. I mean, an example would be David Cameron saying, oh, yeah, when I started out, Matt. I mean, you know, when I first became Prime Minister in 2008, people said, look, are you going to make the rich richer? Are you going to make the poor poorer? I think we managed to do both. So that kind of works. It works on a character level, and it works on a satirical level, and it works on a fun level. And that's so ideally what you're hoping to do. And with Donald Trump, now, you know, I got to say, Donald Trump, you know, he couldn't make it up, but he does all the time, by the way, just like, but I'm trying to think with him, the thing is maybe to use his vanity against him. So if he now starts to boast about his failures, you know, let me tell you now, Matt, I have now got the lowest approval ratings of any president. I started on 47, it's now down to 40%. That was below Obama, below Clinton. We had the fastest resignation, 24 days. Mike Flynn, great guy, by the way. And I'm now the most expensive president in history. It's going to be great. Going to be wonderful. So you've got the voice. You start with that, but then you've got to put the material on it. And I think if you want to do the satire stuff, you do have to put a little content in there. And otherwise, it's just graffiti. Otherwise, it's just saying, you know, politicians are a bunch of idiots. I mean, I do say now in the Atlas, you know, part of the job is to make politicians look more ridiculous than they are. And have you any idea how hard that is these days? But like Matt Ford, actually, I am still, you know, I'm a fan of politicians. I think, you know, they are valued. And we see all, albeit in the most tragic circumstances, if you see, you know, we all remember Joe Cox, and then just you know, a week or two ago, Tobias Elwood, and you think, you know, there are many decent, honourable politicians. And as somebody once said during the financial crisis, that 99% of bankers give the other 1% a bad name. In a sense, it's like that with politicians, that people say, oh, they're all in it for themselves, and they all... And I think that's really corrosive. I remember Tony Benn, who was quite a fan of Bremner, Bird and Fortune, and sometimes we used to go to Tony Benn, and I would say, we'd just have a little conversation about what was going on. He said, well, I think you should do a sketch about William Hague. I think you should do a wonderful sketch about this. And he said, the only thing is, he said, if you undermine people's belief in their politicians or their member of parliament, or if people lose confidence, if people lose trust, then where does it get you? And the point that's, it's really, it's an absolutely important point, because, you know, if you do give up on politicians, then you get a situation where you think, well, let's get the private sector in to run everything, and in fact, let's do away with parties. Why don't we just get a businessman in to run the country?
And Matt, wouldn't that be great?
I think that would be wonderful. And what they've done in America is essentially, if in Britain we decided that we're going to do away with politicians and just choose Philip Green to run the country. But politicians, and the reason that Trump is already unravelling is because he's not a politician. They elected him because he wasn't a politician. But politicians, they're the ones who have to make the compromises. They have to learn that they've got to bring two sides together. And I'd argue that actually Theresa May hasn't really been successfully doing that, particularly over Brexit, where it was 52-48. And in a sense, you know, the difficulty was to say, OK, we accept what that vote is, but we have a divided country, and somehow or other, I have got to lead a compromise in which both parties can get as much as they can from this situation.
It feels sometimes like, because she was on the Remain side officially, she's overcompensating to persuade the leavers that she is with them now.
Well,
hasn't taken the Remainers with her.
She has this habit. There's a recent book, I think, was it Rosa Prince, who wrote, she's written a biography recently, and I read a review by David Runciman, who's a sort of hero of mine, about Theresa May taking a brief from somebody else and then carrying it out to the letter, you know, absolutely, incredibly diligently, in the face of all opposition, and all sometimes in the face of all logic. And that's why she has no truck or no time for Gove or Cameron, who she sees as being sort of lightweight, because they come out, they toss out an idea, and then they change their minds on it. And Theresa May, it was like, I think, when Cameron came in and said, I think we should reduce immigration to the tens of thousands. And Theresa May took that literally, and she was busy in the Home Office slashing student visas for Indians. I think she slashed 10,000 a year for 5 years, so 50,000 fewer student visas, because she was absolutely bent on fulfilling this brief of getting immigration down, because that was what she'd been told to do. And I think there's a certain inflexibility about her. And, you know, I think she... has thought, right, okay, that's the message. We're leaving, and I'm, and we're going to make it work. I can't do Theresa May.
Well, I was going to say,
you need to get Jan Raven.
I was going to ask you, do you ever do women?
No, well, I did. I've done it in the past. I did. I've done Anne Widdecombe. Much more that sounded much more like Margaret Rutherford, and I did Esther Ranson in the past when it was just more about her sort of signposting everything and manipulating the audience, and she herself used to tease me about how bad it was, but I'm on tour at the moment doing this tour called Partly Political, and in it I have Jan Ravens as a guest.
Okay.
And she comes on, she does the most fabulous Theresa May, she does a wonderful Theresa May, she does a fantastic Hillary Clinton, she does a great Diane Abbott.
Diane Abbott is incredible.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's really great. If anyone hasn't heard, just look it up, because there's on YouTube she does. But don't look up, you have to spell Theresa May right, that's very important.
Yeah, don't Google it without the H.
I did do that. I had to introduce her once. I was doing a debate with her. Chris Huhne was in it. Do you remember Chris Huhne? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he did all that stuff. Yes. And he was the one. He was arrested for speeding. He said it was his wife who did it, and they got divorced, and she's having nothing to do with him now. And she's got a point. Well, she's got 3 points, actually. But anyway, so he was there, and Theresa May. So I did my research. I was hosting the debate, and so I looked up Theresa May, and sure enough, it said nude model and soft porn actress, because I spelt it wrong. And so I thought, I'll just use that. I'll introduce her. And I don't think she was very happy about that. But anyway.
Her renowned sense of humour didn't kick in.
No.
How do politicians react to it? Do they like...
I don't know.
Being impersonated or not?
It's difficult, because you need to get sort of close enough to them sometimes, and sometimes you're drawn into the same circle. But you try to keep an objectivity about it. I mean, John Fortune once said to me, he said, well, nobody ever criticised David Attenborough for getting too close to the animals. So it is possible to study them at close quarters. I remember Tony Benn, I mentioned him before, and he said, are you doing me in the show this week? And I said, yes, we are. He said, well, that's good. He said, because if you're not doing me, I feel in some way I don't matter. And I thought that was quite sweet. Yeah. And then he said, but don't be too hard this week, he said, because I'm off to see Saddam Hussein this week. This is 2003. He said, I'm going to see Saddam Hussein. He said, I've got to see him on Saturday or Sunday, because I'm going to be in Leeds on Tuesday. So I love the characters.
Yeah.
And this is something that Bird and Fortune also share in common. I love Fortune in particular. I just love the characters. And this is why, for a while, the coalition, this is interesting, because, I mean, we had the Great Beasts, and Spitting Image did a lot in the 80s to kind of give a character to Thatcher's cabinet, because in some ways they were quite unpromising. You know, Ken Baker and Leon Britton and Norman Fowler and people like that. But, you know, they, and Douglas Hurd, Prime Minister! You know, all that. So Spitting Image gave them characters. And Labour came in 97, quite fully formed. We knew who they were. We knew that John Prescott, a little, I was to blame, a little bit like Les Dawson, but, you know, so we had him.
There's very little difference.
We had David Blunkett, don't pat the dog, he'll have your fucking head off. we had Tony Blair, obviously. I just think he's warm. And Gordon Brown. So people knew who they were. And then the coalition came in, and rather like Kitty Muggeridge said of David Frost, they rose without trace. So when the coalition arrived, and you had these people like Chris Grayling and Jeremy Hunt and Philip Hammond, and you thought, whoa,
that sounds like a list of people you've got.
Oh,
a list of you would never ever attempt.
Well, we thought John Major was great, but they made John Major look like Camilla Batmangelis. You know? So the coalition was, it coincided with the ending of the series that we did on Channel 4, that stopped in 2010, but it meant. And I'm sad about this. It meant that the whole of the coalition went by without us being able to do a programme about it until the very end. And we did a programme, I think, in April, and the coalition finished in May. Now, was that a coincidence, Matt? Yes, it was. It was a complete coincidence. But Cameron was there, and I think he was dual, and Boris. And, of course, we saw the rise, ultimately, of Farage. So now the characters are back. And now politics is back, I would argue, actually, as well, because I think there was a time from about the mid-90s, really, when economics was the only game in town, and politics was entirely subservient to economics. And you can see an illustration of this by, look at the political editors that are now. So on Sky, their political editor is Faisal Islam, who was Channel 4's economics editor. ITV, you've got Robert Peston, who was the BBC's business editor. Newsnight is now presented by Evan Davis, who is the BBC's economics editor. Yeah. So economics was the big thing. And then I think in the last 3 or 4 years, and this has been the big shift, that politics has come back, and it came back with a Scottish referendum in 2014, came back with Corbyn, it's come back obviously with Brexit. So politics is back, and coincidentally, luckily enough for me, some of the big characters are back.
Who do you love doing? Who's your favourite?
I gotta say, I love Trump, but I hate Trump, but I know the voice because people relate to it straight away. And always I kind of open a show and say, we got so many people here today. You know, we look around this theatre, we gotta have 70,000 people in this theatre tonight. And you're looking out to a theatre of about 600 people. Tom Lehrer said years ago, he said that satire became obsolete when they gave the Nobel Peace Prize to Henry Kissinger. And what is interesting now is we've moved so far on from that. We just had Tony Blair as Middle East Peace Envoy, a job he gave up last year. Well, yeah, mission accomplished. I don't think it's ever been more peaceful in the Middle East. So we've had that. We've got Trump as president. We've got Boris as the foreign secretary. And you can't make it up. Well, Trump makes it up all the time, as we know. And you know, you have these ludicrous situations, like as soon as Nicola Sturgeon calls for the second Scottish referendum, then it gives the Tories a problem, because who are they going to send up to Scotland? Because when they sent Cameron and Osborne, it was like Edward the First and Will Carling being sent up. The idea of they'd send Boris. I see Nicola Sturgeon. I see the idea that you would willingly break away from a political union with your closest neighbour and your biggest export market. It is. Oh, hang on. oh, look, a puffin. So there is so much that is going... I mean, in the last couple of months, what we've learned, that Richard Whiteley was a spy, that George Galloway is writing children's books, that Paul Nuttall is running UKIP. I mean, so it's interesting. Comedians will say now... Well, people come up to you as a comedian now and they say, God, you've got so much material. But usually when that happens, it means that the material is being written for you already by the politicians. Comedians will tell you that in a way that presents its own problem, because you've got to find a fresh angle. You know, if it is all very serious and non-farcical, then of course you find ways of making it farcical. But if it is farcical already, you're just sort of framing a picture that they've painted already, and it's less original. But on tour at the moment, you are aware of the ground moving under your feet. But I do feel, I mean, I often start off that these are the three big things that is in everyone's mind at the moment. I say it's like I was given for Christmas by a friend who doesn't like me very much. I was given three box sets, and one's called Brexit, and one's called Trump, and one's called Corbyn. And I don't want to watch them. I don't want to sit through them. I just want to know how they end. because clearly, you know, and we do feel, looking at Trump now, it's like watching a really bad mistaken identity film, and you think, this is bound to, you know, when is this going to? And I keep rewinding it backwards, so I get to a happy ending. And apparently Melania, his wife, says she wants to be the next Jackie Kennedy, so she's obviously thinking the same thing. Too soon.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What about the Europeans? Because over the next couple of years in our relationship with Brussels, could you find yourself doing Donald Tusk and
Well, Jean again, Claude you see, Juncker. People would need to know what who they sound like, yeah. unless you make them sound as the all-purpose, you know, European bureaucrat enemy, which kind of would go counter to my politics. I mean, that brings in the interesting thing about, I think, in a way, if satire is to be meaningful. I mean, I would argue that actually the closest we got to satire was those wonderful pieces that Bird and Fortune did, because they had the time and they had the space to really delve into an issue, and they used all the weapons at a satirist's disposal.
And your politics then come
that's right
into
yes
it.
Exactly what I was going to say was, in a sense, if you have writers just writing a stream of jokes for you, then it is topical comedy. But I think you need to have a point of view. So for example, because I have a sort of Remain mindset, you know, the idea of just doing a bunch of silly Europeans sounding like Goering or Himmler would not be kind of, I wouldn't want to do
that's
that.
Not making the points that you want to make. Yeah,
exactly. Although funnily enough, Jan Ravens does a really good Angela Merkel, and she does a really good Christine Lagarde, and she said to the bosses at the BBC, she said, wouldn't it be great to have them, you know, sitting in a cabaret one evening, sort of just talking in a jazz club or something. And the commissioner at the BBC said, no, but Eileen in Leeds wouldn't know who they were. What you're trying to do is to, although you make a caricature, you can't sort of put a caricature onto another caricature, if you like, because the biggest revelation that I had recently about Europe was Bird and Fortune went there about 20 years ago, maybe more, to possibly do a programme about Europe. And they found themselves in Strasbourg on the famous day that the Parliament was debating the harmonisation of lawnmower noise. Okay? And I think they must have just gone straight back on the train and thought, well, that's it. You know, how can we parody that, a Parliament debating lawnmower noise? And it was only about 6 weeks ago that I realised that I read that debate had been initiated by the British, because the Germans had been using national legislation to stop British lawnmowers coming into the country. And so Britain says, well, we need to debate this in Parliament, because we need to have, if we're to have a level playing field, and indeed if we're to have a moan playing field, we need to standardise things across the community. And what's interesting about that is that something that you thought was just a complete waste of time and ridiculous, and in a sense summed up the futility of the European Parliament, you then realise that actually it was the essence of the European Parliament, which is to say that if you're going to have one of the biggest markets in the world, an open and free market, you need to have those regulations, so that somebody who makes, I don't know, a coffee machine in Halifax or in Lisbon or in Milan, whatever, they operate to the same standards and they can sell everywhere in the community. So suddenly the very thing that you think was a caricature turns out to be actually something good.
I think there's probably a lot of people who are having the same revelation as we go through this process of negotiating our way back into a new relationship with Europe, discovering that there was a point to a lot of it all.
Well, absolutely. Well, I go back to something that Bill Clinton said years ago about another election. He said, the people have spoken. It's just we don't know what they said. And I feel that's true about the referendum, because, as we know, it's a binary thing, that people said no for so many reasons. And in fact, the ultimate reason was, say, it was like, are you really pissed off? And people said, yes, we are. And for some people, it was about immigration. For some people, it was about sovereignty. For some people, it was just, we're really fed up. I talk about this in my show, that in a way we've got improvised governments on both sides of the Atlantic making it up as they go along based on suggestions from the audience. And Brexit wasn't so much a serious suggestion as a really angry heckle, because they were saying, we've had enough, we're fed up with politicians. And that's what I understand. I totally understand that people were really angry, and that people felt, a lot of people, they felt they were left behind by globalisation. A lot of people had lost their jobs because of it. The politicians, the liberal consensus, the neoliberal consensus, hadn't mitigated globalisation. And so, in a sense, they left the door open. And on the other hand, you had the demagogues like Trump in America, but Farage and UKIP and whatever, that exploited that and turned it into, you know, blaming foreigners in general and Europe in particular. So I understand the anger, but the way I say it is that, you know, I feel that the public, that they were barking up the right tree but at the wrong cat. So, you know, they were right to be angry about the politics, but in a sense to take it out on Europe, which to me very much needed reform, don't get me wrong, really needed a lot of reform. Nevertheless, there were so many things about cooperation between 28 countries that was, you know, a positive and a good thing. But Europe didn't help itself. I had a conversation, a brief conversation with David Davis, which is really illuminating, because this is just in the corridor at the BBC, and I said, look, why didn't, I mean, Europe did not help itself. Why didn't somebody like Tusk come over? I mean, so why didn't Juncker make the argument? And David says, I know, he said, yeah, great name, isn't it? And I thought, my God, that is your mentality. You are still thinking that Europe is about Junkers and Stukas. And it was extraordinary when Boris talks about punishment beatings and things. And I thought, you know, when you think that the greatest thing, the funniest thing about Juncker is that he's got the same name as a bomber. But I think that's quite kind of illustrative of that mindset that I think is still the, you know, lurking behind is the fact that we're still going around as people were a couple of weeks ago singing two world wars and one world cup, when Angela Merkel has moved on and is busy singing no world wars and three world cups, which is what Germany's managed to do since 1950.
When you're going around the country and you're doing your show, does the reaction to what you're doing change, the audience reaction? Because obviously different parts, one of the striking things about the Brexit result was the way that the result was so different in different parts of the country. So the reaction to what you're doing?
Well, it's a self-selecting audience in many ways.
You're just going hoovering up Ramonas.
Well, I thought there might be sort of a kind of a more liberal audience, but the first show I did was in Cheltenham. The first thing I said, okay, right, who's feeling really happy at the moment? Expecting, as it was quite soon after the vote and Brexit was near, I expected the audience to go, oh, and who's really confused and miserable? And for them all to, so anyway, I came out and said, right, who's feeling really happy? And they all went, way! And I suddenly realised that in Cheltenham, of all places, it was quite a Leave audience.
Yeah.
And my guest that night was Alistair Campbell, who actually managed to pick a fight with two pensioners in the front row, which was hilarious, because they said, you know, we left because we're patriots and we don't like being controlled by Brussels, which was a red rag to Alistair Campbell's bull. And so off he went. And then that happened around the country elsewhere. I had Anna Soubry was my guest in Chesterfield. People said, you know, that we were biased and all that. And it's this thing that people have got now, that if you express a point of view that you're biased, and I said, no, it's not, it's just a point of view, I'm not the news. But even the news, interestingly, is so haunted by this thing of bias that I now think that if Hugh Edwards had Ellen MacArthur, you know, the round the world yachtswoman, he says, okay, thank you, so Ellen MacArthur there, who has completed her round the world voyage, I say round the world, I'm joined now by a representative for the Flat Earth Society in the interests of balance, because you know, we've kind of overdone this thing. And so I said at the time, look, no, this is just our point of view, and if you disagree, then okay, you disagree, but you know, obviously we still haven't swayed you. But you know, there is definitely, there's a kind of tension out there, but genuinely I kind of, my instinct is to try and bring people together, and laughter can bring people together. But I learned a lot. The most I learned was David Runciman did a very good, he was my guest one night, and he was terrific, and he talked about, as Paul Krugman said after Trump was elected in America, Paul Krugman said, I think I truly didn't understand our country. There were all these university towns who voted Remain, but within 4 or 5 miles of the university towns were these huge pockets of Leave. And he said that, you know, their experience was totally different. Mm-hmm. So in the university towns, as we know, 15% of university staff are EU nationals, and we have, that's 125,000 EU students. So their lives were international. They were, as Theresa May said dismissively, they were citizens of the world. They were as likely to be sending emails to Rome or Paris or Lisbon as they were to send emails to London. And whereas within 5 miles of them were people whose experience was totally different. Somebody else described them as the everywheres and the somewheres. The people whose experience was local and whose lives had been affected by globalization and not in a good way. And I don't want to alienate those people. As I say before, I've completely I understand, but I just think that the danger is that in taking it all out, we need needed to kick a cat. But what I said about that was, in a way, that we, not only have we thrown the baby out with the bathwater, but we've thrown out the bath as well. And, interestingly enough, the people who plumbed it in.
Yeah.
Because
the plumbers have
got it. 39,000 Europeans, Eastern Europeans, left in the first 3 months after Brexit.
Just before we finish up, I just want to ask you, what, in America, we've seen this Saturday Night Live has sort of been reborn thanks to Donald Trump, and not just
it's been great, I want to say.
Not just Alec Baldwin, but I mean, even the Sean Spicer impression, that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
don't have something like that in the UK. There's nothing on UK TV which is capturing that, whether it's the anger or the, whether it's anger about Europe or anger about the result. There's nothing which is,
I agree,
seems to be tapping into that.
I agree. I mean, we haven't really sort of captured the spirit. I mean, the, you know, there's the Now Show and News Quiz, sort of like they're doing, that's carrying it on Radio 4. And there are pockets where you look for it. Andy Zaltzman, I've mentioned maybe before, Matt Ford does a certain amount of politics. But I think we've got out of the habit. There's a lot of reasons. I mean, partly there's the instant response of Twitter and social media now, that they can be so fast, and people, it's almost like years and years ago, I wrote a piece about what I call the karaoke culture, that instead of, you know, people who are really good at singing or really good at comedy doing their stuff, now it's a feeling that everybody can do it.
Yeah.
And journalists are saying that every journalist, that everyone's a satirist now. So yeah. There's a sense that everyone's a satirist. There's also the commissioners, and I think I'm told at the BBC, they say, well, we haven't got the budget to do the show that you want to do. ITV, they said, you wouldn't give us the ratings that we need, which is interesting, because Spitting Image, they got 12 million. Yeah. Channel 4, they're using Andy Hamilton and Guy Jenkins to do sort of more scripted sort of sitcom yeah. type satire. I think there's actually a failure of nerve as well. I think the BBC...
Given the attacks that particularly BBC get just for their news coverage, the idea
absolutely.
Of them putting up a show which either attacked Remainers or Leavers seems...
Well, it occurs to me that it's like the will
risk.
Of the people. It's like the will of the people that has become an absolute, that you daren't, you must not, you know, betray the will of the people. Similarly, people say, you are the BBC, you know, you are, I pay your license. And the BBC's ability to be challenging and to be confrontational. I mean, you know, they're most criticised for this by newspapers who themselves are absolutely biased in one side. I mean, you know, when the Mail goes after the BBC all the time for bias, you think, well, you know, and I'm aware they're different organisations, but I think the BBC does need to rediscover some of its confidence. It lost a lot of it on the Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand
yeah.
episode. The low point, if you like, was when they wouldn't run an emergency appeal on behalf of Palestinians for DEC, I think it was, because at that time it was Mark Thompson, and they wouldn't run a humanitarian advert for fear of, I think it was the Israeli lobby.
Yeah.
And you thought, well, you know, it's a refugee crisis, but you're worried about a political lobby. And I think the BBC needs to rediscover that confidence. But I think the audience is out there. But when you see something like The Nightly Show, I mean, you know, I don't know if that was an attempt to do the sort of... I don't think it's a million miles from a Jon Stewart show, because, you know, you see, it doesn't look... There, in America, you get the sense that there's a politically engaged, vibrant, energetic audience. I think politics almost has been marginalised in that sense, but it's expensive to do as well, because you need to have good researchers, particularly
yeah.
if you're going to do it every night. It needs to have proper research, proper backup, and really commit to it. And I was really surprised when ITV shifted the news. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
And doing The Nightly Show, you think, oh, here we go. This is this long-awaited answer to Letterman or answer to John. And you know, it was a sort of rather strange hybrid. The danger is that if you have a generation where we're not used to that kind of thing, the commissioners, it becomes a self-fulfilling thing. They think, well, you know, the commissioners don't think the public would take it. Like, they wouldn't know who Christine Lagarde and
absolutely,
Angela
yeah, yeah.
Merkel are. And so it doesn't get on. And it's a real shame. It's a real, real shame, because I far from satire undermining politics, as I hope I said earlier on, it actually engages people. It reinforces. People watch Spitting Image, and after that, they knew who people were. When we did Alistair Campbell and the Tony Blair sketches, when we started out, people said, oh, they won't know who Alistair Campbell is. And we said, well, they will do by the time we finished.
And particularly at a time when people are so much more politically engaged because of the referendum, and people who hadn't ever voted or hadn't voted for years and years and years went out and voted. It feels like there's a...
Oh, it's an intensely political time. I remember Rory Stewart during a debate the night before the Scottish referendum. We were in Edinburgh in a Channel 4 debate, and he said, well, look, I understand that politics has failed. He said, and he was drowned out by angry Scots who were saying, effectively, no, your politics has failed, but our politics is up and running, and our politics, it's about, so obviously, social media, it's about campaigns, it's about this whole movement. And so, as I said earlier on, I think politics is really, it's vibrant and it's out there, and we should be able to make a programme where people can talk about it and people can be funny about it and be engaged about it. But this, you know, still this cloud of bias hangs over it. This cloud, which obviously from my perspective, I think of it as primarily angry leavers. But leavers would equally say, angry remainers. But we are in danger of being so divided at the moment. I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, we could bring it together with comedy. But it's kind of a tough gig at the moment because I think there is a lot of anger out there. And I don't know.
Can we bring it together? I don't know, Matt. I don't know. Really, I don't. But all I know could be written on a stamp.
Well, on that note, Rory Bremner, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you. Can I have a record now?
To make sure you don't miss the next episodes of the Red Box series on politics and comedy, subscribe via iTunes or on your Android device. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.